Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Welcome back to another Books with Hooks. For our new listeners, welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you would like to submit to this segment, please go to our website, theshitaboutwriting.com. Go to the Books with Hooks tab. All the information that you need is there. We would love to hear from you. All right, as per usual, we are diving straight in. Cece, can you please read us the first query letter?
Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, thank you so much for your incredible podcast. I wouldn't be the writer I am today without all your invaluable knowledge, and I know many others who feel the same. I am seeking representation for Haunted, a young adult historical romance with paranormal elements, set in 1800s Edinburgh. Complete at 76,000 words, this story will appeal to fans of Anatomy, a Love Story by Dana Schwartz, and Belladonna by Adeline Grace. 17-year-old Flora McKelly has spent her life protecting the dead. Growing up in a watchover tower overlooking a Scottish cemetery, Flora has always connected more with the ghosts only she can see than the living outside her gates. The greatest threat to the dead has always been the resurrection men, stealing bodies and selling them to the doctors at the College of Medicine or to the secret society looking to uncover secrets only the dead can answer. When mysterious fires crop around Edinburgh, using up bodies and ghosts in a way Flora has never seen before, it's clear no one, living or dead, is safe from a dark power rising in the city. To save her ghosts, Flora must leave the comfort of her cemetery behind and team up with Lachlan Crane, a resurrection man who has spent years digging up graves in her cemetery in the dead of night. As they uncover the truth behind the fires, Flora must learn to trust someone other than herself and shed her aversion to spending time with the living, all while grappling with her own feelings for Lachlan, the resurrection man who she always believed was her enemy. They'll need to work together if they have any hope of saving themselves, their city, and the dead Flora has sworn to protect. I am an award-winning journalist who worked for one of Canada's top daily news providers before moving into public relations and communications. I am an active member of best-selling author Adrienne Young's Writing with the Soul community. When I'm not writing, I enjoy exploring cemeteries with my golden retriever, Heidi, to see what stories we can uncover. Haunted is my debut novel, and I'm currently drafting my next project. I have included the first 5 pages below. Please let me know if I can pass along the completed manuscript. Thank you for your consideration. Sincerely, Catherine Hill.
Thanks so much. Could you please give us the word count, CC, and then your take on that?
Okay, so where should we begin? First, this opening line is the kindest thing. Thank you. I hope everyone knows that whenever we're reading query letters and we get lines like this, it always makes us feel so special and so grateful to have our community of listeners. And it really just means a lot to us. So thank you so much. I thought that you did a really good job with the first paragraph because you gave me all the metadata, like title, word count, comps, really, really in a really tight way. And I know that's hard to do. So excellent job there. I did note a few things in the plot paragraph that could be tightened. So here we go. Using up bodies and ghosts in a way Flora has never seen before, right? Like that's essentially like the rising action, if this is clear to me. And I'm wondering, what does that look like using up bodies and ghosts, right? They're fires. So like, are the fires burning the bodies? Are the fires burning the ghosts? Is that even possible? I guess that wasn't super clear to me. And if it's like a world building thing, I understand you not wanting to reveal it, but I'm just wondering if there's a different verb you can employ as opposed to using up. Just because I wasn't clear on what that meant. I also noted that you introduced Lachlan twice. So we have one sentence that reads, team up with Lachlan Crane, a resurrection man who has spent years digging up graves. And then the next sentence reads, Lachlan, the resurrection man who she always believed was her enemy. And you don't need the introduction twice, right? As a small thing, but these small things matter. Remember, agents read queries in batches, and so it's really important to really make sure every word is very intentional. You have a reference to dead of night. So Lachlan has spent years digging up graves in her cemetery in the dead of night. So first, I think you can remove in her cemetery because it's just extra words and it just adds one more person to the equation. Like, we understand that it's the cemetery where she is. Second, dead of night. Like, there's already so many references to the dead. I don't think you need dead of night, right? That's just what he does. At night, it's fine. And again, I'm being super picky here because I want to make sure that you succeed. And I really, really like the idea of someone who can see ghosts. I am a huge fan of shows, of books in which people can see the dead. I'm always like so curious. When I was a kid, I very much wanted to see the dead. Like, I remember my first experience with death. I was very, very young. It was my great-grandmother dying. I remember being like, when can I see her now? And like people telling me that you can't. After people die, you don't get to see them anymore. And I was very disappointed at that. That was not fair. And I still don't think it's fair. And I'm like basically 40. So you go. Some things you never really lose. I really love the reference to your golden retriever. And yeah, thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, we're handing it across to you.
All right, here are my notes. So the title, I'm like, Haunted, it's a fine title. It's a good title. Is it a great title? I don't know. Your comp anatomy, colon, a love story. I'm like, that has something to it, right? And often, you know, it's like, colon, a novel or something like that. But I don't know. I think you might benefit from something, a longer word. We also have to think about SEO and, you know, when people type things in and the book they're looking for and Haunted, there'll be tons of books that come up with the word haunted, right? So if you know, add a word here and there or colon something, 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 I think that'll improve your SEO in the eventuality when your book is published. So this project really made me think of the Graveyard book, and it is too old of a comp. Obviously, it's a huge comp, it's Neil Gaiman, but if you ever did need some comps in your back pocket down the line when you're talking to somebody in person, I do think, you know, that would be a handy comp to have in your back pocket in another context. All in all, like, I found this really interesting, pretty ominous. The only thing I think that I struggled with was, why does she need a teammate? You know, why does she need Lachlan? Why do they need each other? And where are her parents / family? Those were some of my questions. Because if she's 17 years old, presumably she still lives with her family. We don't know for sure. And then the fact that she has to team up with him, I don't really quite understand why she needs him. She said always believed was her enemy. They have to work together. So it just wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't clear like why the mashup had to happen. I could have used a little bit more clarity on that. And also, what's at stake if they don't solve their problem. Because when we have an otherworldly problem, it exists on another plane. Do you know what I'm trying to say? And it becomes so much larger than itself. So I'm almost wondering, you know, what's at stake here? Because it says saving themselves, the city, and the dead Flora has sworn to protect. What's at stake if they don't accomplish this? I think that's still a bit of a question mark for me, but it's very interesting. I think it's unique. Yeah, and it's dark, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, what was in those opening pages?
So we have our protagonist watching a ghost's body be lowered into the ground. The ghost is stoic, unlike so many other ghosts who are usually struggling and confused. The protagonist talks to the ghost and explains that she needs to accept her death to move on. We don't know move on to where, neither does the protagonist, though she believes it's a better place. And through interiority, we learn that the protagonist wishes peace to all the dead, and whenever she isn't able to help someone move on, she feels very sad. She doesn't want ghosts to become ghouls, who are the spirits who were not able to move on, and they start looking differently, a little spooky, a little eerie, and, you know, she feels very strongly about her mission to help people cross to the other side.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, sounds like there's going to be quite a bit of interiority and emotionality there, which should make you happy. Let's hear your take on that.
Okay, I want to start by saying that the writing is really polished. Excellent writing, excellent scene work. Scene work sounds easy, right? Knowing who's there, what is there, what are they focusing on, people moving around. Scene work is hard to do. It sounds easy, but it's not. It's like whenever I watch sports, it looks easy moving that ball around, but I'm sure it's not because I've never held a ball in my life. That is a lie, but you know what I'm saying. So scene work is hard. So good job, lovely person. Scene work is very hard. I also think that the hook is very cool. I really, really loved the hook. I do think that, and I think this is going to be a controversial take, I don't think you're starting in the right place. I'll tell you why. I like the idea of seeing her doing her thing, seeing her help a ghost go to the other side. But she is so level-headed. I actually highlighted, and our subscribers will be able to see my highlights, all the references to how calm and serene she is. She is in control all the time. So her emotionality isn't active. You know, she's serene, she's quiet, she's in control. Like, that does not lead to active emotions. And it's really beautiful. And as a human being, I admire her. And it tells me a lot about her character. But it doesn't really propel the story forward with active emotions. And so I think that we either need a disruption, a challenge to occur. Like, I like the idea of her starting out level-headed and in control because it shows that she's done this before. It shows that it's her thing. But again, some disruption has to occur. The ghost, like, you chose a stoic ghost. And to your point, most ghosts are not like that. And so the conversation between them is very calm. You know, she goes, what's happening? And then the protagonist tells her, well, you have to accept your death so you can move on. And, you know, it'll be okay. And so everything is just very calm. And I don't think that that is the ideal place to start because it's not really propelling the story forward. In addition to the disruption, which I think you should add, I also felt a little bit of a plausibility issue when it came to her dialogue with the ghost. So first, I love that the ghost's name was Grace. That was a really cute detail because she was graceful, and I'm sure that was intentional, and I really, really like that. I really like the way that we find out her age. It's so subtle because we find out the ghost's age, and then she thinks to herself, barely older than my 17. So that's a genius way to share her age. But Grace isn't surprised to see her at all. Like, Grace just talks to her. And again, plausibility. Like, if Grace knows she's dead, isn't Grace surprised that someone can talk to her? Would Grace maybe assume she was an angel? And that would tell us about Grace. It would maybe reveal that she's religious. Also, wouldn't Grace have something to ask of her? Like, here's the thing. If I just died, I have so many things I want you to tell. My husband, my sister, my mom. Like, I just feel like if a ghost knows that there's only one person she can talk to, most likely she would ask things of her. And the big, big thing. At one point, the protagonist tells Grace, I can wait with you as you prepare to move into the afterlife. To do so, you must accept that you have died. You're buried now. Return to the earth. And yes, Grace is about to ask her if she can raise the dead, and the protagonist says no. But like, if raising the dead is not possible, because that was smart adding that, the next thing Grace would ask is, what does accepting look like, right? If I have to accept my death to move on, what does acceptance look like? Like, what does she have to do? So I really wanted more questions from Grace or perhaps something else to just solve that plausibility issue because to me, it doesn't make sense that Grace would be A, so calm, but fine, maybe she's a calm person, but like, she would want her to pass on a message. She would have unfinished business. She would want to know what acceptance looks like. I struggled with that. I was like, I'm not sure that that is believable to me. But it might just be a case that, you know, I'm a very, very skeptical person. And so maybe that's the issue. Maybe it could be a me problem.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, what were your thoughts?
I really love the first line. I'll read it to you guys. The ghost doesn't cry as her body is lowered into the ground. Super interesting, because it's like, there's some separation between the ghost and the body. We know that they're not the same at this point. Anyway, I thought that was a really good, curious. I love really strong line breaks and an opening page. To me, it just looks really confident. Like, it's very punctuated like a poem. It's like, this is the line, period, next line. So I think all of that punctuation and how it appears on the page is really strong in this section. There's also a good amount of information being told, but there's not this whole like info dump. And I think I just want to applaud that balance between telling us what we need to know when we need to know it and really nothing more. And I think all of Cece's points are absolutely correct, but I think this is an incredible world, like a very specific world I can exactly picture. And that's why I was thinking of Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book, because that's another very like visceral graveyard type of story, and I could really just picture where we would. Another line I liked was, the living will be fine, period, the dead need me, period. Like, I don't know, just very, again, really confident language. So I think the author did a really excellent job of that. And yeah, other than that, I didn't really have a lot of notes. Like, I was kind of into the story. I was, you know, trying to figure out, like, what does she know and why does she know it and when are we going to find out more? And I think I felt, as I said, reminiscent of The Graveyard Book. And so I was very much just like willing to kind of go on this haunted graveyard journey with her. I didn't have necessarily like reader expectations, which is kind of good and bad, right? Like, I was turning the pages, I was willing to keep going, but I hadn't really built up expectations in my mind as a reader, which is, I think, what Cece was trying to get at with her notes.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, we're going to our second query. Will you read that for us, please, Carly?
Here we go. Dear Carly, Kitty Baby is a 70,000-word literary coming-of-age horror. It's Diz Tate's Brutes meets Mona Awad's Bunny and would appeal to fans of the Nova Ren Summa and Tess Sharp in the YA space. You may be interested because of similar titles you represent. J.L. Richardson's Gutter Child comes to mind and is one of my recent favorites. I submitted a different project for the show in the past, which was generously critiqued. That book is out in full with a few agents, exclamation mark, in the event it goes nowhere. However, I better have backup. 16-year-old Mona is the leader of the Kitty Babies. Three young women living in a remote trailer in rural Vermont. Unsupervised, they are bored and looking for someone to buy them booze. When they spot 21-year-old Key visiting her mother over the July 4th holiday, the kitties pounce. Key has recently experienced a string of bad luck back home in New Jersey. Her apartment burned down, she lost her job, her parents split up. The kitties watch her run errands around the small ski community, now empty of rich tourists for the summer. They eventually approach Key and demand she buy them alcohol. When she refuses, Mona and her kitties follow her back to the big house, where Key's mother had been staying in exchange for caring for the out-of-town owner's cats. The kitties take Key and her mother hostage, first demanding alcohol, then cash. Then they convince Key she's under a curse cast by her new boyfriend in Jersey. She has to admit a lot of bad things have happened since meeting him. The group drives to the Jersey motel where he lives, intending to make him remove the spell. But what if there is no curse? Or maybe there is, but he's not the one who cast it. I have an MFA from Redacted. My work has been published by Flame Tree Press in the UK, Purpled Nail, Rue Scribe, and elsewhere. I live in Vermont with my husband and two dogs. Thank you for reading. I hope you want more. A huge and humble thank you to you, Cece, Bianca, and Emily. Name Redacted.
Wonderful, Carly. Thanks so much. Can you give us the word count there and your take on that?
The author graciously gave us the word count, so I know what it is. It is 361 words. Okay, so in terms of my kind of questions for this project, I'm kind of curious, and I don't know, I never usually ask this at the query stage, but I'm very curious about whether it's in first person or third, or because in literary fiction, it kind of matters to me, like how you've set this up. Based on the way that you've pitched this, I'm assuming it's third, but just think about maybe, I don't know, potentially including that. As I said, with literary fiction, it does kind of help frame the way that you're going to tell the story. So it could potentially be helpful here, but that could just be my opinion. So of course, take that with a grain of salt. I can really picture this atmospheric rural Vermont in their trailer. I don't know. I can just picture these three girls living in a trailer very vividly. And so I really think this is a very atmospheric moment. In terms of the language choice here, so when you're pitching something that's literary, I assume that there's going to be a certain kind of command of language. And so I think this is well written, but I'm almost just wondering about like word choice, for example. When they say the kitties watch her run errands, wouldn't they say like spy or something more ominous? This is a horror, and we'll talk about that later. Why aren't we using more atmospheric horror language, something more ominous, something like, I don't know, just staring down the barrel? I just felt like the word choice and the tone and the genre weren't matching up for me in a way that this could have been a home run, because I do think this is really interesting. It ends up being a bit of a play-by-play, I think. You know, they eventually approach her and then demand that she buy some alcohol, and then they follow her to the big house. And you know what I mean? It's a bit of this and this and this and this. So it ends up being a bit of a play-by-play. I want to know where the horror is coming in, because this whole like spell bit is interesting. But we'll get to the pages later. I'm like, where is the horror on the page? What about this is horror? You know, those are some big question marks at this stage. You know, I've made some notes of things I think that we could potentially cut. Anybody who subscribes to our Substack can get our notes and kind of see exactly what I'm getting at here. But as I said, I'm really curious about what is the heart of the book? Is the heart of the book the horror and the curse? Or is it these three girls kind of running feral alone and in this town? I don't know. For some reason, these feel like kind of two separate things to me, like the setup of where they are versus them driving to New Jersey and then trying to figure out the curse part. Those feel very separate to me. So I'm not sure how we can kind of merge them together other than just explaining the curse piece with a little bit more clarity from the beginning. Another small thing, and again, this comes back to me potentially not knowing if this is first or third person at this stage, but they say, we know that they're 16. And then when they spot 21-year-old Key, how do they know she's 21? And that's when I was like, oh, okay, clearly this is third person and I'm having this like omniscient, like overseeing this whole story thing. So those were the kind of things where I'm like, I think that I get what's happening here, but I have a lot of question marks. And so I just don't know that this version of this query letter will ascend to get you the requests and things like that, because there's so many question marks. But the concept is really strong. I think it's really interesting if you could just hammer through some of these notes.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Cece, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree with everything Carly said, and I will summarize my thoughts in one line. The query letter is not doing the pages justice. It's just not. That's all I have to say.
Okay, author, you've got work to do there, but that bodes very well for the pages. So, Carly, will you give us an overview of what's in the pages, and then we can discuss those in more detail?
All right, the opening pages have a few different sections, so I'm going to kind of explain this section. So we open with a very short, it looks like an epigraph because it's in italics, but it says, one will be dead by Sunday night. So, okay, all of a sudden we know somebody's going to die on Sunday night. This wasn't mentioned in the query letter. Okay, then we jump to the next section, which is July 4th, 6 o'clock in the morning. And we get a play-by-play of the girls. It says they take the big house. So it's like them basically doing what was told to us in the query letter, which is they are, you know, taking siege of the big house. And so we kind of have a little bit of a play-by-play. It's not in scene. It's very much like describing to us what's happening, describing the girls to us. And we're kind of seeing this in a very literary context, the play-by-play of them taking the house. Then we are in Mona's point of view specifically. And we are in her point of view with her and her mother. And we think that there are cops coming towards them. And then we kind of learn a bit more of like a drug habit that she has. And that is essentially where it is.
Great. Thank you. Before we go to your take on that, as Carly said towards, it's made me think of how many manuscripts I've looked at where people overuse the word towards. Go through your manuscript, search for it, and most of the time you can just replace it with to, because towards is a very specific word, and if you overuse it, it can stick in your head. That's a note to myself to do it on my own manuscript right now. Helpful to all of you. Okay, Carly, what was your take?
I feel like I need to check all my emails now. It's one of those words I'm like, I need a sticky note in front of my computer now. All right, so like, I think the command of language here is very high. I think this is really incredibly written. And I think what Cece was getting at in her very succinct summary was that these pages are so much better than the query letter. And as we always say on the show, that's a better problem to have. We can always rewrite a one-page query letter. So having a stronger page is much more important. But yeah, it gets at the central question for me, as I kind of alluded to when I was trying to summarize this, was somebody's gonna be dead by Sunday night? Like, that is important information. I didn't know somebody was gonna die in this book. That's a completely different book. So that is definitely information that we need in the query letter itself. So when I read literary fiction, it is not my primary category of what I work on, but I do represent select literary fiction. What I am looking for when I am reading literary fiction is, when are things overwritten? And when it's like, I can see that the author is trying to say the same thing in a few ways and just like hasn't taken the red pen to certain sections yet. And I think overall, this project does a pretty good job of that. I made a couple notes where I was like, I don't think this makes sense. And so there was like an attempt at some, you know, literary prowess. And I'm like, I just don't know. Like, that's an example of like, probably should have taken the red pen to that. But I think there's a lot of really, really great writing. I think I'm going to read the first paragraph of the first section, which is, they take the big house in the early morning after a couple of knocks and an obnoxiously long ring. The girls capture the place easily. Small girls, three of them, who weigh nothing at all. Key almost thought, because of their size, she could take them. Their leader, especially, with blackheads so deep they'd be visible from space, wearing a dress that wouldn't hold a single blow to a nose. I just love that. I'm like, okay, I can see what's happening here. I can picture this all. I think there's really great word choice there. The wearing a dress that wouldn't hold a single blow to the nose, I think there could be a little bit more like refining in that piece, meaning, is it because it's a bit short and flimsy? It's like she can't fight in it. That kind of idea. I think that's what you're getting at. But that's an example where, you know, I think we just need like one more word in that sentence or a slight tweak. And then again, we've elevated it in another capacity. So overall, I think, you know, and anybody who's reading my notes in the Substack will be able to see exactly what I loved about it. One of my notes is around this idea that we are kind of summarizing a lot of content in these pages. For example, they talk about when they approach Key, like they do in the query letter, to, you know, get them some booze. It's like they say, hey, do us a favor, get us some rosé, get us some claws, some noon, something sweet, would ya? And then we go through the interaction, but I would have preferred this in scene and not in recap. So I think, again, that could have been an opportunity for this author to flex their muscles in that capacity, because we've already done a lot of summary work. And I just don't want to keep like doubling down on this type of storytelling when, again, as a literary author, you should be able to flex your muscles in a couple of different ways. But again, these are all just my opinions, and literary fiction, more than other things, is obviously very specific to just me. When we do get to the mom scene and the police are coming, there's a line that says, there's a leg hanging out the door, now an arm. I was very confused by that. I was like, I didn't think they were driving. They were in the house, but then they're watching the cops and they're watching some sort of chase. I was a little bit confused by that. But then when we grounded ourselves in learning a bit more about the mom and the drug addiction and the siblings, a lot of that came kind of more clear for me. But I think that's an example of the author was attempting to do scene work here, and then it just didn't land. There was only, I don't know how many words that would be, maybe like 50 words, 100 words of scene work. And I would have just wanted to be in those scenes more before we jumped into the other style of writing.
Thank you, Carly. Just on that, from my point of view, I would say, you know, wearing a dress that wouldn't hold a single blow to the nose. I think what the author means is the dress is so threadbare that it wouldn't hold up somebody blowing their nose against it. So that's really easy. Wearing a dress so threadbare or so flimsy that it wouldn't hold a single blow to the nose, that's an easy fix. Just be aware you've used take twice in the first three lines. They take the big house, and then she thought because of their size that she could take them. So just be aware of that repetition there. That's why reading your work aloud is super helpful. Okay, we're handing it across to Cece now.
Because I have so many allergies and I'm always blowing my nose, I also thought that that's what she meant. I didn't think she meant punching. I thought she meant like, it's so, so flimsy that if someone were to blow their nose, the dress would fly off. First of all, can we talk about how Carly called me succinct? Yay! Points for me. I get a crown today. I'm going to eat extra cookies because this has never happened before, and I'm going to mark the day on my calendar. Yes, 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 yes.
We'll have to mark it again in 6 months when you're succinct.
I thought you were going to say in 6 months when she finishes.
Once every 6 months is very, very, very ambitious and optimistic of you, Carly. Thank you.
That's a goal we can work towards.
Thank you. Okay. So Gosh, my first note. So our subscribers will see this. Okay. Usually I have so many line notes, like endless line notes. And usually that's a good thing because it means that my brain is working, right? As I'm reading your pages and you're really making me think, and that's excellent. My first and only note on the first page is, wow, your writing is really beautiful. And then my first and only note in the second page is, I've said it before, but I'm going to say it again. Wow, your writing is amazing. I did have actual notes after that, but it just blew me away. Like, this is very, very good. You are a very, very strong writer. All the applause. Please be very proud of yourself. People say things are literary and then they don't deliver literary always. Sorry to be so harsh. You delivered literary. This was very, very good. Okay. How can you improve? You are head hopping and you can pull it off. I don't think I've ever said this to anyone. You are time hopping. And then that is I'm struggling with. Like when we started chapter two, I was like, wait, did we go back in time? Hold on. What's going on? And I was confused. And so you are amazing. You are very talented. You are still dealing with humans who are tired. Not just agents. All humans are tired. Readers are tired. It's 2024. We all have the attention span of moths. So I really think you need to reconsider the whole going back in time, time hopping thing, like timestamps, just more clarity. It's necessary. I also think I got to a point where like, yes, writing is beautiful, but you are asking way too many questions. And they're not actually questions you're asking. It's your way to deliver information and it's beautiful and it's musical and the rhythm is amazing. But you did go a little overboard in my opinion. And I did mark the moments where I was like, I would tone this down. So yeah, really these again are my only notes because this is really good. This is amazing. If I repped YA, I'd be calling you right now because I really, really love this.
Thank you so much to you both. Two great queries and opening pages today. Well done to those authors. Thanks, Carly and Cece, for your incredible feedback. Right, let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th for a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Today's guest is a freelance TV executive who has worked on popular factual shows, including the BAFTA-nominated Secret Life of Four-Year-Olds. Burr's writing was selected for Penguin's Write Now program, and in 2021, he graduated from the Faber Academy. He previously studied at Westminster University's Film School. In his spare time, he volunteers for Age UK, a charity for the elderly. He lives in London with his partner, Tom, and their cat, Muriel. He's always been old at heart. It's my pleasure to welcome Samuel Burr. Samuel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So fantastic to be here.
It is so wonderful having you here. So the book we're discussing today is The Fellowship of Puzzle Makers. And here is the flap copy. Clayton Stumper is in his 20s, but he dresses like your grandpa and fusses like your aunt. Abandoned at birth on the steps of the Fellowship of the Puzzle Makers, he was raised by a group of eccentric enigmatologists and now finds himself among the last survivors of a fading institution. When the esteemed crossword compiler and main maternal presence in Clayton's life, Pippa Allsbrook, passes away, she bestows her final puzzle on him. A promise to reveal the mystery of his parentage and prepare him for life beyond the walls of the commune. So begins Clay's quest to uncover the secrets surrounding his birth, secrets that will change Clay and the Fellowship forever. The Fellowship of Puzzle Makers is pure joy. It is a story about love and family and what it means to find your people no matter what age you are. So I would love for you to take us through the whole process, your journey to publication, and how the hell you came up with comparative titles.
Well, it's been a journey and it has taken a while. It has been going on now for several years. I'll tell you a little bit about the process of how the book came to be. So I, like you said in my introduction, I work in television. I haven't actually worked in TV now for a little while just because I've been writing and editing. But yeah, my background's in television production and my job was as a development producer. So I used to pitch and devise and develop new TV shows and then sell them to broadcasters. And so I've always been quite creative, always had lots of ideas. And I had sort of, you know, success in television, particularly in the early part of my career. Sort of, it was all very, very exciting and lots of things were happening. But as anyone will tell you about television, there's so much work that ends up just in the bin and is just wasted. And for a while, I could kind of put up with that because when you do get a win, it is kind of amazing. When you see an idea on screen, it's kind of incredible. But after a while, I started to get a little fed up of just the amount of work that I was doing that just wasn't going anywhere. And basically, what I found really frustrating was the fact that in order for me to turn an idea into an actual thing, in a TV show, I needed to get, you know, £1 million budget signed off. I needed, you know, 10, 12 people to sign it off, the whole chain of command leading all the way up to the controller of the channel. It was really, really tough. And so the thing that appealed to me about writing a novel was the fact that no one could tell me not to do it. And actually, the only person that was going to stop me from it was me. All I needed, I'm making it sound very straightforward, which everyone knows it isn't, but all I needed was a sort of a laptop and imagination and a lot of determination. And so that's where it all started. I wanted to take an idea that I had in my head and turn it into a physical thing. I remember thinking, if this doesn't get bought by a publisher, I'm going to get it. I don't think I would have been self-published, actually. I don't think I would have gone down that road, but I would have printed it out for myself. I would have had a lovely bound copy of my book that I had created, and the story would exist, you know, forevermore. So that was the ambition. I signed up for a creative writing class at the Faber Academy in London, which is in London. There's sort of two fairly prestigious writing academies. There's the Faber Academy, Faber being the publisher, Faber, very literary press, independent press in London. And then there's also the Curtis Brown Academy, which is sort of one of the big agents. I stand up for the Faber course, and on the first class, our teacher said to us, can you tell us all about what your novels are going to be about? And I didn't have anything. I literally didn't have a single sentence of my book written. Lots of people had the first draft already written. So I was really intimidated. But I'd had this idea about a community of puzzle makers. And it's quite a long-winded story to get to how I got there. But essentially, I'd started writing another book, which was called Hilda O'Donnell Holds All the Aces. And it was about an older lady called Hilda, who was a champion bridge player. And she had won huge fortunes playing bridge all around the world. She lived in a big grand house in London, and she had a young lodger living with her, who was Clayton. Clayton obviously being the protagonist of my that's coming out. So it all started there. I sort of loved the idea of including a bit of gameplay within the text, but I've quickly found bridge to be not only boring, but incredibly complicated. And so I actually thought, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to broaden this out, because card games is one thing, but puzzles actually are something that we all have a connection to. I think that's one of the things that appealed to me most about puzzles, is that you don't have to be a sort of champion puzzler to sort of understand the appeal of puzzles. We all have memories of, you know, playing with jigsaws with our grandparents, or, you know, doing, you know, crosswords on the subway, whatever it might be. And so what I decided to do is write a book about a group of people all with their own sort of puzzling specialisms. And to put this character at the heart of it from my first book, and his name was Clayton. And what I loved, the idea that really excited me, was the idea of having a young man who was in a very old world, surrounded by much, much older people, but him being at heart much older than they were. Because the thing that's great about professional puzzle makers is that they've sort of committed their lives to having fun, and they know how to enjoy themselves. And Clayton, start of my book, doesn't really know how to enjoy himself. He's much more straight-laced. He's much more sensible. He's kind of the grown-up in the situation. So that's where the book came about. I wrote the first draft at this writing academy. The academy then sends out an anthology to agents across the UK. And I remember the day so vividly, the day that the anthology went out, and everyone waits at their computers waiting to see if any agent's going to contact you. And I was so, so lucky. I had agents from, yeah, actually not just in the UK, but in America too. I think I had 14 agents contact me off the back of it. And so then I sort of went and met a few and had, you know, chats with a few of them. And quite quickly, my agent, Haley Ogden at WME, I just knew quite early on that she was going to be the one. She had such a great vision for the book, but also she had such passion. And she was actually willing to sign me on a partial, which is quite unusual. So I actually didn't share the whole manuscript with the agents. I think I sent probably 1,000 words. And so it was really great, is that I then, at the next stage of the writing process, I was sort of revising my draft with an agent sort of checking in on me, which was so, so fantastic, because it meant I had that motivation to sort of get it done. I knew that I was doing it with the purpose of, you know, someone was actually going to read it. I mean, that's always the scary thing, isn't it? When you're working on a manuscript for so long, and you think, God, no one might even read this. So yeah, it's been a bit of a whirlwind, but yeah, that was 2022. That the deal was done. I mean, yeah, obviously lots of editing with my agent. The submission went out in 2020. So it's been a while.
And when it went out, was there a lot of interest in terms of the different editors who you pitched it to? Was it a case of, again, you got to choose who your editor was, or did one publisher come in with a really strong offer and you were like, okay, that's who we're going with?
So it sold in an 8-way auction. So, and it all happened really, really quickly. So went out, and so I remember ringing my agent and saying, how long is this going to take before we have any sense of, you know, if anyone's interested? And she said to me, within a week, we'll get a good sense if anyone's keen. And I think she was sort of saying that just to sort of calm me, because I was sort of obviously waiting by the phone. And what happened was, the book went out on a Wednesday. I'll never, ever forget. It went out on a Wednesday. I was in my writing group, online writing group on Zoom, and we were all talking about work. And all of a sudden, my WhatsApp notification pinged up on my laptop, and it said from my agent, it's out in the world. And I remember thinking, oh my God, sort of feeling both quite sick, but also actually weirdly quite calm, because it was the only time really where it felt kind of out of my hands. The manuscript had sort of gone, and it was the first time in literally years where I couldn't tweak it. I couldn't change it. I was constantly editing. I was constantly writing notes and thinking about it. And actually at that point I could have done, and I knew at that point I couldn't have done any more myself to that manuscript. So yeah, it went out, and then, yeah, I think within maybe 48 hours, I think we had 7 or 8 preempts. And my agents advised me through the whole process, and we turned them all down, and it went to an auction in the end, which was incredible. It was just after COVID. So one of the publisher that I went for, Orion in the UK, they actually hired the pub that the puzzlers meet in London. I don't think you could do this in America, but so my puzzle makers in the book, in the first few chapters, they meet in a room above a pub in London as a sort of puzzle club. And yeah, the publisher actually booked that room and did the pitch in that space. So it was really, really cool. I've actually got the launch party there for UK version in the same pub. So yeah, it was a kind of mad period and sort of a whirlwind, incredibly exciting and exhilarating. I look back now and I think, did I enjoy it as much as I should have done? Because it was great fun, but it also was really nerve-wracking too. It's one of those things about something that feels so big. It's like a dream come true moment, but it goes on for so long before anything's confirmed. So you're just waiting and waiting and just hoping it's all going to come together. And it did. So yeah, it is a bit of a fairy tale, but we're really, really lucky. I think, yeah, the way that people have responded to it. I think in terms of, you asked me earlier about the comp titles for our book. I guess some of them would be, we used titles like The Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osman. I guess not because there's no crime in my book, there's no sort of dead body, but there are a very eclectic group of older characters at the heart of the story. So that was one of our comp titles. We also had Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus as one of our titles, and AJ Pierce as well, Dear Mrs. Bird, which I think did really well. It definitely did well here. I'm not sure how it translated in America, whether it was published. I think it was. And actually, we've been so, so lucky to many of the other sort of comp titles that we added in. I remember Alexander McCall Smith was sort of there, and Joanna Cannon, another British author. Been really, really lucky. A lot of those have been good enough to accept proofs and even blurb for me for the book. So yeah, it's a sort of an eclectic range of comp titles. I guess we were trying to sell the tone as well as the subject. But I think one of the things is you never want to sell a book that feels completely unique, because a book that's completely unique is very hard to sell. So we had those sort of touchstones of tonally being a bit similar to Lessons in Chemistry and having the sort of cast of Thursday Murder Club, but having sort of puzzles infused within prose and having it as a book that you can read and you can play was our sort of USP. That was our selling point that allowed us to get people excited about it, I think.
Yeah, and for our listeners, you know, when you're struggling with comps, listen to what Samuel's saying, because sometimes you are. The tone of this, the playfulness of this, the sense of isolation of this particular character, etc. So these are things, even if you can't find the perfect comp. And here's the thing, you know, it was actually incredible to pick up this book and to read this book and to love this book, as I know that readers who love puzzles would approach my book. And Samuel is now hopefully creating a market into which my book can slot down the line, because people are going to be like, well, if you like The Fellowship of Puzzle Makers, then pick up this book. Only it's just, you know, got magical people and there's a murder there, but these are the touchstones of it, which is awesome, awesome for the rest of us. And yeah, that literary citizenship in terms of getting those authors to blurb you, especially when you're a debut author, because I think there's nothing worse as a debut. No one knows who the bloody hell you are, and you're going out and being, please say nice things about my book, right?
Yeah, it was the most sort of rewarding part of the process, also the scariest. And yeah, you kind of think, I remember, you know, when we started to get yeses from a few of my favorite, literally some of my favorite authors, and I just couldn't believe that they were even accepting the proof. And then for them to sort of read it and to say nice things about it, I was just blown away. There's an author called Joanna Cannon, who I'm kind of one of my literary heroes, and she's been such a fantastic porter. I've sort of called everyone that's blurbed for the book in the very early stages, I'm the Friends of the Fellowship. And yeah, I'm actually going to be doing an event with Joanna Cannon where she's interviewing the UK quite soon. So yeah, it's been incredible. And that has been, I think, one of the things that I've learned about this process is when you give your book to sort of people that you know, you sort of expect them to say that they, and so when I gave it to my mum and dad, they read it and they were like, we loved it. And I thought, well, yeah, you're going to say that. But when, you know, Alexander McCall Smith says he is it, you're like, well, there's no reason for him to say that unless he did. So it's a lovely, lovely feeling, actually. Yeah, it's been one of the best.
That's incredible. Are you going to be coming out to North America at all on tour? Are you waiting to see how that's going to play out?
I'm not sure. It might be maybe for paper backstage, sort of a bit of a question mark at the minute. But if there's appetite, I'd love to come and do some events in America.
It would be wonderful to see you here. Okay, so let's dive into the book itself. In terms of a debut, it is so incredibly assured. It's such strong writing, just some lovely, lovely descriptions that made me giggle. So for our listeners, there's a few that I've underlined and highlighted that I've absolutely loved. But there's one here particularly that I could just perfectly bring to mind this character. So listen to this. A landlord suddenly appeared beside the barmaid, a portly chap with a swollen gut like a giant marble, so perfectly contained, it appeared as if it might shoot down and pop out one of his trouser legs if he sneezed. So just encapsulating this visual, you know, of a character incredibly, incredibly quickly in just a few brush strokes, which is really what you want to do. When it came to Clayton himself, he felt so familiar to me. From the first page, he felt so assured, so intrinsically himself. Do you think it helped that you had spent so much time with him in a previous novel that you really got to know him at a cellular level so that when you transplanted him, it wasn't a case of, okay, who is this guy? What's his motivations? You know, what are his mannerisms? How does he think? Did he just feel like he was already alive on the page for you?
I'm going to be very honest, Bianca. I am very similar to Clayton. I am a massive young fogey. And I think one of the things I haven't spoken about is that part of the inspiration for this book was in my very, very, very early stages of my TV career. I actually made a documentary before I became professional TV, but I was at film school and I made a documentary inside a retirement village. And me and my friend Danny, we were like 19 years old and we moved into this retirement village. And we lived in the village for a week with all the 80-year-olds. And the thing that I loved about that whole experience was, one, I sort of learned that I loved spending time with older people because they had just fantastic stories. Everyone had sort of a little secret up their sleeve and they all just had, you know, brilliant stories to tell. I also loved the fact that by the end of the week, me and Danny, my mate, were absolutely exhausted because they had the busiest social lives. You just could not believe how busy they were. Every night they were doing a different activity. There was drama club, there was karaoke, there was darts in the pub. They were just so busy. And so I remember as we were leaving the village, making them all laugh by saying, God, I can't wait to go home and put my feet up as a 19-year-old. So that was also part of the inspiration. And I love the idea of having a young man who's sort of very much old at heart, surrounded by old people who are young at heart. And that is me. I've always got a boiled sweet pocket. And yeah, I've just always been quite old.
I love that. I don't suppose you're a Capricorn.
No, Cancer.
Okay. They say that Capricorns are born old and we just get closer to our birth year every year. So I've felt exactly the same. So I was like, Samuel's kindred spirit must be a Capricorn. In terms of the puzzles, you know, because these are two very different skill sets. You are busy writing a novel. It's got to flow a certain way. You need an inciting incident. You need to up the stakes. You need tension. You need to have causality where one thing happens, which leads to the next thing and the dominoes are tipping over. All of that is difficult enough in kind of a three-act structure novel. When you are interspersing puzzles and then you have to focus on creating the puzzle, how the puzzles create meaning in the story, how the two speak to each other. I don't know about you, but I really struggled with that because I found that that was a hell of a challenge. Did you have some help with the puzzles? Well, the puzzles all you? I'd love to hear what your experience of that was.
Bianca, it was an absolute nightmare. I'm not going to lie. Absolute nightmare. I just basically
so glad to hear that.
Oh yeah, we should talk about it because we know the pain of that. I mean, it is kind of extraordinary. I remember several months into the edits, it was kind of the edits where it became really challenging. And I remember getting several months in and thinking, oh my God, what have I done? This is, you know, on the paper, this is such a great idea. And actually to pull it off, it was really, really challenging. And I do remember thinking, this is my first book. What was that? Should have been so much simpler. But like Pippa Alsbrook in my novel says, nothing worth solving is ever easy. And we got there in the end. It was lots of meetings with my publishing team, lots of sort of late nights, but lots of bottles of wine. I'm not going to lie. It was, yeah, basically what I tried to do was I had all the sort of themes. I basically had all the solutions worked out before I had the puzzles worked out. So I knew what I wanted the solution to be. And I needed to get that all locked in before I started changing things. There was an awful, awful moment where my American publisher, Doubleday, it was Anchor Books at the time, they quite quickly gave feedback, which is that the cryptic crossword, which was at the heart of my novel, which is a very particular type of crossword, is not a thing in the US. And you love your crosswords, but you do not do the cryptics. And actually, weirdly, it is a tradition here in the UK, but it is so, so complicated that it's actually, it's more common for people to do the sort of your version of crossword. We'd call it a quick crossword, which is a bit arrogant, really, but it's a sort of more general knowledge based rather than sort of using riddles and complicated wordplay. So there was a moment where I was actually contemplating having to do two different manuscripts of two different crosswords, one for the UK market and one in the US. And I just, God, no, this is not going to work. But actually, there was a fantastic moment in the process because my American editor, Caitlin, said to me, it has to be led by the characters. It has to feel right for the characters. And actually, one of the things I love about Clayton, one of my protagonists in the story, is that he is the kind of odd one out. He isn't a puzzle maker. And in fact, in the first chapter, he sort of reflects on the fact that he's never been able to solve a crossword in his life. So actually, when Pippa dies, the founder of the fellowship, when she passes away and bequeaths her final puzzle to Clayton, she wouldn't have set him a puzzle that she knew he couldn't solve. So she sets him a puzzle that he can solve, and hopefully lots of people, both in the UK and US, can solve too. I was really keen not to write a book that, because there's nothing worse than puzzles that feel deliberately too difficult, sort of end up, I just had visions of people throwing my book across the room, and I didn't want that. So I wanted there to be a right mix of complexity in the puzzle, so that people felt suitably challenged but didn't feel kind of annoyed.
Yeah, I think hitting that sweet spot is so important. I made the mistake early on of showing the puzzles to various people, who many of them did puzzles, some of them didn't. Some said, I didn't come close to figuring this out. And others were like, oh, I figured it out in a minute. Could you please make them a bit more difficult? And then you're like, oh my God, you've got to find that balance. But besides the fact that you challenged yourself with these puzzles in your debut novel, something else you did, which is really difficult to do as a debut author, is you had dual narratives. You had Pippa and Clayton's, and you had dual timelines. Sorry, I have to emphasize the dual, because as a South African, I say dual, and I had somebody write into the podcast to ask what a dual timeline was, J-E-W-E-L. So I'm emphasizing that. So those are both really, really tough to do. So can you talk a bit about the challenges of that?
It's weird. It's one of those things that just felt really weirdly quite natural when I was writing. I knew that I wanted to tell it through two perspectives. It did make it hard, I think. I mean, I've got nothing really to compare it to, because it's the first book I've written and I've never not done that sort of style of writing. But I'm doing it also in my second book too, because I really enjoyed that side of it. I think one of the things that I was really interested in is the idea that as people, we often go on similar journeys to our ancestors. And so what I was really keen to do was, through Pippa's timeline, show the sort of life lessons she's learned, and then for Clayton to sort of be acting on them. Yeah, to be set the challenges from Pippa in the other timeline, so that we're sort of seeing him learn the mistakes that she's made. And it was good fun. And one of the things that I thought worked particularly well doing a dual timeline sort of style of writing for a mystery book was that it's a really lovely way to unravel a story. You can sort of unpick parts of the story and the narrative in different ways at different points of the process. So sometimes there'll be a bit of mirroring between the past and the present. You'll see Clayton doing something that clearly he's learned from Pippa, because we see Pippa doing it in the past. I had great fun doing that, the sort of, and also nodding to the reader a bit. I think this is one of those books where you can kind of, the reader is acting as a detective. And so to seed the clues in both the timelines and to be able to sort of pull the rug from people's feet sometime and surprise them with little twists, that's kind of, I think, what people are hoping book like. With a book about puzzle makers, you kind of expect that. So yeah, I had great fun doing that and plotting it all out.
In terms of the timelines, so were you writing it the way we're reading it, backwards and forwards, or did you go, okay, I need to plot out Pippa's whole timeline so that I know what Clayton's timeline is going to look like afterwards? Or was it a case of you're just an incredible plotter, you had it all there up on the board and you knew exactly how you were bouncing?
I wish I was an incredible plotter. It's total chaos, to be honest. What I do is, I with this one, I spent a long time in Clayton's perspective. I think it took me a few months at least to work out that I needed Pippa's perspective too. So I think I started writing a lot of present tense story from Clayton's point of view, but it was a really difficult thing, because the first chapter of my book, this isn't a spoiler because it's the first chapter is Pippa, the founder of the fellowship, lying dead in her open coffin and all of the puzzle makers standing around paying tribute to her. So I'm sort of starting the book with an ending, which is something I always like to do. It sort of feels like a nice natural way to kick off a story, sort of the sort of end of an era, start of a new chapter. But it did limit things, and so I knew quite quickly that yes, I'm gonna have to seeing the world through her eyes too. What I did find was that it was impossible for me to jump between the two perspectives. So I would basically spend several weeks writing Clayton's chapters, and then when I felt I'd sort of reached, my limit on that section, I would then sort of almost fill in the gaps in Pippa's story, just so I could have that consistency. Otherwise, you're sort of jumping between different heads and it gets quite complicated. I sort of want that sort of consistent voice. So yeah, that's what that was my strategy.
Yeah, it worked incredibly well. The last thing that you did that was also really, really tough for a debut novelist is a big cast. You know, even though we have two POV characters, there is a big cast of puzzle makers and people who all live together. And you've got to get it very clear very quickly in the reader's mind who they, you know, who does what, how they stand out from somebody else. Any advice you have for our listeners who are also dealing with big ensemble casts who you need to differentiate and distinguish quickly?
Well, that was one of the biggest challenges. And I think that was one of the things that was one of the main edits after signing the deal. It was one of the main things that came up. And that was really hard. I mean, I remember getting quite a good way into the manuscript and I'm writing a book about basically a commune. It's a very large house, crumbling old mansion in the UK. And so it needed to feel more, you know, it needed to be occupied by more than just four or five people. Otherwise, it just didn't make any sense. So that was a real challenge. And one of the things that I really spent a lot of time on in the edits was giving each character basically a puzzling specialism. I sort of did that in the manuscript that I sold, but I didn't do it as specifically as I have in the book that's on sale. So they were sort of, there were two ladies that were into word games who, you know, worked with Pippa, and there was a man who was very good at numbers and things. And actually what I tried to do is just keep it really specific. So in the first page of my book, there's actually a sort of membership register of all the members. And actually I wrote that quite early into the edits, those big main structural edits, as a guide for myself almost more than anything. I'd sometimes just, you know, look at the scene and think, okay, I need three or four people here from the list. Who's going to be the most interesting to have? And actually, is it the code breaker? Is it the master of mazes? Is it the queen of quizzes? Is it the prince of pieces? You know, they all had these little, you know, funny, jovial names. And I sort of went very, very, very specific. And I think that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed doing, actually, is sort of trying to tell, I describe it as big stories in small worlds. So telling big universal stories that could relate to anyone, or you know, anyone in the world almost could identify with, in a place that is very, very specific, almost even niche. So my cast of puzzle makers, there aren't that many professional puzzle makers in the UK. So it's a very, very small group, and it's what they do is very, very specific. And yet the story, what the book's really about, which is about finding yourself, finding your place in the world, you know, is something we can all hopefully relate to. And that's what I'm doing in my second book too, actually.
Amazing, amazing. Well, you know, I interview a lot of authors for the podcast. I feel like you and I, Samuel, are kindred spirits in terms of the way we approach these books, in terms of the frustrations, etc., that we had, and in terms of the story itself. You know, I wish so much that I'd known about you while I was working on this book. I feel like you and I could have zoomed and banged our head against our laptops a few times as we were trying to figure all this stuff out. For our listeners, I'm linking to the Fellowship of Puzzle Makers on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get it there, you support an independent bookstore and the podcast and Samuel at the same time. Samuel, we cannot wait to have you back for the second book.
Thank you so much. And I can't wait to read your book, Bianca. I'm hearing that I might be getting an early advance copy. So I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you so much.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Litera Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Litera Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.